Hey, Contra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, if you've ever looked around at the world, or maybe just looked inside at your own complicated, sometimes anxious thoughts, and asked yourself, why is it so hard just to be happy? Well, this deep dive is definitely for you.
Yeah, today we're plunging into a really challenging one. Sigmund Freud's 1929 work, Civilization and Its Discontents. It's unsettling.
It really is. And our mission today, our goal, is to unpack Freud's central argument, which is pretty provocative. He basically says that the very things needed for society to advance are fundamentally at odds with our deepest individual needs.
Exactly. We're trying to understand why this feeling of discontent, this unhappiness, isn't just some accidental byproduct of civilization, but maybe, just maybe, the actual price we pay to be part of it.
Right. Why are we, as humans, capable of creating incredible art, science, technology, all this comfort? Yet we often feel perpetually restless, maybe even unhappy. Freud's claim is pretty radical. It's not a personal failing.
No, he argues it's a feature, not a bug, of being civilized. It comes down to this fundamental bargain we strike between our primal instincts and the demands of social order.
Okay, so before we get into the nitty-gritty of civilization's collective neurosis, maybe we should talk a bit about the man himself, Sigmund Freud. For anyone needing a quick refresher, who was he, and why was his particular background so well-suited or maybe unsuited to diagnose society?
Well, Freud, as you know, Austrian neurologist, really the founder of psychoanalysis, his main focus wasn't big picture sociology or politics. It was the individual mind.
Right. Treating neuroses, those deep internal conflicts. He gave us concepts like the I, the ego, the superego.
Exactly. The id being that, you know, raw primal desire, the ego, the sort of rational manager dealing with reality, and the superego. That's the internalized voice of authority, like your parents or society's rules, the inner critic.
And that clinical focus, dealing with individuals, is what makes his take here so unique, right? He spent decades listening to people's deepest, sometimes darkest secrets in therapy.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't just making abstract theories about society. He was applying insights from actual human suffering, individual suffering, to the whole collective experience.
It's like he put civilization itself on the couch.
You could definitely say that. He saw laws, religion, art, all of it, as these complex mechanisms that the collective ego builds to manage and often repress the powerful and messy instincts of the collectivated.
And the timing matters too, doesn't it? He wrote this in 1929.
Yeah, absolutely crucial. This was just after World War I had completely shattered that sort of optimistic European belief in rational progress. He'd seen firsthand how thin the veneer of civilization could be.
So that horror, that experience, must have given his study of aggression a real sense of urgency. It wasn't just academic.
Not at all. It was a deep psychological response to seeing humanity's destructive side unleashed on a massive scale.
Okay, so let's really get into the core idea of civilization and its discontents. What's the fundamental conflict he's talking about?
At its heart, the book is about this unavoidable clash. It's between our individual instinctual nature, which he says is driven by the search for pleasure, the pleasure principle, and the frankly crushing demands of living in an organized society. Society forces us into what he calls the reality principle.
So I want immediate satisfaction. I want what I want now. But society forces me to delay, to cooperate, sometimes to give up entirely on what I desire.
Precisely. Civilization is necessary, right? It protects us from nature, from each other. But it demands a huge price. Instinctual renunciation, as he calls it. We have to suppress or hold back our most powerful urges, especially our libido, our sexual drives, and also our innate aggression, all for the sake of maintaining order.
That's the price of progress, then. We make the sacrifice. But Freud says suppressing these instincts doesn't make them disappear.
No, not at all. The energy is still there. It just gets redirected, dammed up. And that forced redirection, that bottling up of powerful natural energy, is what leads directly to neurosis, to internal suffering, and this kind of universal discontent.
So his conclusion is pretty bleak. Sustained happiness, defined as like constant pleasure, is basically structurally impossible within this set.
Yeah, we trade the sort of wild, absolute freedom for regulated safety, and the cost of that safety is our psychological peace of mind. It's quite a trade-off.
Wow. Okay, that's a profoundly pessimistic starting point. Let's unpack the specifics. He starts by looking at why happiness is so elusive, even critiquing spiritual paths. He talks about this oceanic feeling, What's that about?
Right, the oceanic feeling. It's that sense people sometimes describe, that feeling of limitless connection, of oneness with the universe, often found in mystical or religious experiences. Freud acknowledges it exists.
But he doesn't buy the spiritual explanation.
No, he tries to psychologize it. For him, it's not some glimpse of a higher reality. He thinks it's actually a regression, a throwback to our earliest infancy.
Like before a baby develops a clear sense of self versus other, that feeling of unity with the mother.
Exactly. He sees it as a powerful feeling, yes, but fundamentally a regression to a state before the ego properly formed its boundaries. It's looking backward, not upward.
Okay. And since he thinks true, lasting happiness is basically off the table, he points to things that always cause suffering.
Yeah, three main sources, he says, are unavoidable. First, our own bodies. They're fragile, they decay, they get sick. That's unavoidable suffering.
Makes sense.
Second, the external world. Nature can be brutal, disasters, diseases, just the harshness of existence.
Also unavoidable.
And third, and this is key for his argument about civilization, the suffering we cause each other, our relationships, social structures, conflicts, this is a huge source of pain.
So if happiness is impossible and suffering is inevitable, what do we do? How do we cope?
We turn to palliatives, basically painkillers for the soul. He mentions things like intoxication drugs, alcohol, ways to temporarily numb the pain or escape reality.
Okay.
He also mentions isolation, just withdrawing. And interestingly, sublimation, channeling that energy into things like art, science, intellectual work. But he argues none of these are real solutions. They're just temporary fixes, like bandages on a wound that never truly heals.
Right. Okay, moving into another big concept. This feels almost mythological. The battle between Eros and Thanatos.
Yeah, this is central to his later thinking. It really is like a cosmic struggle playing out within us and within society. Eros is the life instinct. It's about love, creation, binding things together. It pushes us to form larger and larger units, relationships, families, communities, nations.
So civilization itself is basically a project of Eros, trying to build and unite.
That's how Freud sees it. Civilization is Eros's grand attempt to create stable, lasting unities to preserve life.
But then there's the other side, Thanatos.
Thanatos, the death instinct. This is the drive towards destruction, aggression, dissolution, breaking things down, returning to an inanimate state. And this, Freud says, is the constant internal threat to Eros's project.
So the whole enterprise of civilization is always under threat from within, from our own destructive urges.
Absolutely. And this leads to what he sees as the fundamental problem for any society.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage this innate human aggression?
And he insists it is innate.
Okay.
He's not buying the idea that we're naturally peaceful and society corrupts us.
Not at all. He completely rejects that sort of Rousseau-esque utopian view. For Freud, aggression is a primary, ineradicable part of human nature. We are not inherently gentle creatures.
Mm. But hang on, that feels maybe too cynical. What about cooperation, empathy, you know, the drive for justice? How does he account for those? Are they just like clever tricks Eros plays?
Yeah, he'd likely say those are indeed manifestations of Eros, the binding force, working hard to counteract Thanatos. Eros strives to build community, foster connection, create rules for fairness. But, and this is the key, it's always fighting an uphill battle against that underlying destructive impulse.
So the tension is always there.
Always. He sees society as fundamentally fragile because of this, which is why he famously takes issue with the commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself.
Right. He calls it basically impossible, unpsychological. Why?
Because, he argues, it runs completely counter to our primal nature. Our raw instinct when faced with a stranger isn't necessarily love. It might be suspicion, fear, maybe even a desire to dominate or exploit. That's the Thanatos part bubbling up.
So civilization has to invest tremendous energy just to keep that aggression in check. Otherwise,
the community tears itself apart. That destructive instinct would overwhelm the bonds of Eros.
Okay, so how does civilization manage this monumental task? How does it control this innate aggression on such a mass scale? This brings us back to guilt, doesn't it? And the superego.
Precisely. This is where Freud's theory gets really ingenious and also quite dark. Civilization's main trick isn't just external laws and police. It's forcing us to internalize the aggression.
Turn it inwards.
Exactly. The aggression we feel towards others, which society forbids us from acting on, gets redirected against our own ego. This is how the superego, that internal judge or conscience, gets formed and empowered.
The garrison in a conquered city metaphor. The superego sets up shop inside our minds.
Yes, like an occupying force.
Yeah.
It watches us, judges our thoughts and impulses, even ones we don't act on, and punishes us with feelings of guilt and anxiety. The conflict moves from outside between people to inside the individual psyche.
And this leads to that really strange paradox he talks about.
The paradox of guilt, yeah. It's profoundly counterintuitive. He argues that the more civilized, the more ethical, the more restrained we become externally, the stricter and more demanding our superego becomes internally.
So virtuous people might actually suffer more from guilt.
That's the implication, because their superego is constantly monitoring and punishing them, not just for bad actions, but even for forbidden thoughts or impulses that they successfully resist. The morally scrupulous person can be tormented by guilt simply for wanting something society deems wrong.
Wow. So the better we are at following the rules, the potentially more miserable we feel inside. It's kind of a psychological trap.
It really is a vicious cycle. Succeeding at being good, according to civilization's standards, can amplify internal suffering.
Okay, let's try to boil this down into some key takeaways. What are the main themes someone should grasp from this?
Well, the first one is unavoidable, the inherent conflict. This tension between what the individual wants, pleasure, freedom, and what society demands, restraint, order, is permanent. It's not going away. Discontent isn't a flaw in the system. It's the psychological rent we pay for security.
Right. You can't have the benefits of civilization without paying that internal price. What's the second theme?
Guilt as social engineering. This is crucial. Guilt isn't just some abstract moral feeling. For Freud, it's a highly practical mechanism that society cultivates to control us. It's more efficient than external force.
Because we police ourselves.
Exactly. The internal garrison, the superego, works 24/7, and it's free. It makes us regulate our own behavior far more effectively than any external authority could.
Okay, and a third theme.
This one is about our achievements. The double-edged nature of culture. Think about art, science, philosophy, the pinnacles of human achievement. Freud argues these arise largely from sublimation.
Which is redirecting that repressed instinctual energy.
Right. Taking that frustrated sexual or aggressive energy and channeling it into creative, intellectual, or socially acceptable pursuits. So, paradoxically, our greatest cultural triumphs are intimately linked to our deepest repressions and neuroses. Our strengths emerge from the very process that causes our discontent.
That's a really complex thought. Our best stuff comes from our inner turmoil. Okay, this book has some incredibly memorable lines, ideas that really stick with you. Let's touch on a few.
Yeah, he had a way with words, even bleak ones.
Definitely. I'll start. Towards the end, he poses what he calls the fateful question for humanity. Can our culture actually succeed in mastering the destructive power of our own aggressive and self-destructive instincts?
That really captures his deep anxiety about the future, doesn't it? Especially writing between the wars. He genuinely seemed unsure if Eros would win out over Thanatos in the long run.
And another one that challenges our ideas about freedom. The liberty of the individual is not a gift of civilization. It was greatest before there was any civilization.
Oof. Yeah, that hits hard. It perfectly frames the trade-off. You give up that primal instinctual freedom for the safety and predictability, however imperfect, of the group. It's a direct cost.
And then there's that powerful metaphor for the superego we mentioned. Civilization controls us by setting up an agency inside us, like a garrison in a conquered city.
It just paints such a vivid picture of internal conflict, of being occupied by the rules. And maybe the most famously pessimistic line, the one that really sums up his worldview on happiness. The intention that man should be happy is not included in the plan of creation.
Just, wow. It's stark. But maybe, in a strange way, also kind of liberating. It suggests suffering isn't always a personal failure, but part of the human condition in society.
Exactly. It forces a more mature, perhaps less demanding perspective on what life can realistically offer in terms of constant bliss.
So let's try to make this less abstract. How can we apply these pretty heavy ideas to everyday life? If someone's feeling that baseline anxiety or frustration, what does Freud offer?
I think it offers tremendous perspective, actually. It helps you understand that some level of anxiety, that general dissatisfaction, might not be your fault or a sign that you're uniquely broken. It could be a structural consequence of being a socialized adult living within these constraints.
So it's like realizing you're paying the psychological tax for living in society.
Pretty much. And just recognizing that, understanding that some discontent is kind of built in, can really reduce the self-blame. That constant feeling of, I should be happier than this, maybe that should, is unrealistic, given the Freudian bargain.
That does feel potentially liberating. Okay, what about sublimation, that idea of channeling frustrated energy. Is there practical advice there?
Absolutely. Sublimation is presented as one of the healthier defense mechanisms. The practical advice is find constructive outlets for that pent-up energy. If you're feeling aggressive or frustrated instead of, you know, destructive behavior, channel it.
And what kind of things?
Vigorous exercise, competitive sports, tackling a really demanding intellectual problem, pouring energy into a creative project like music or art, even intense gardening. Yeah. Anything that takes that raw energy and transforms it into something socially acceptable or even valuable, it's a way to manage the pressure cooker.
So that super focused colleague working intensely on a complex problem might just be managing their Thanatos really effectively.
Freud might certainly suggest that, yes. And just briefly, you can even look at social or political issues through this lens.
How so?
Well, think about periods of intense political polarization or social unrest or even outbreaks of violence. You could view these as moments where the collective Thanatos, that underlying aggression, is sort of erupting, breaking through the cultural constraints when maybe the cultural superego, the shared norms and controls, weakens.
Like the lid coming off the pressure cooker on a societal level.
Something like that. The destructive drive finds an outlet.
Okay, wrapping up here. What was the most surprising or impactful thing for you revisiting this?
For me, it's the profound way he frames the conflict, not just between us and society, but within each of us. That struggle between connection and destruction, freedom and security, it's playing out inside every civilized person all the time. Accepting that fundamental tension feels like a kind of wisdom.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, the most powerful takeaway is strangely comforting. That feeling of restlessness or discontent isn't necessarily a sign something is wrong with me. It might just be the sound of the machinery of civilization working exactly as intended. It reframes the whole experience.
It really does.
And it leaves you with that big, unsettling thought.
Yeah.
Our greatest achievements, our culture, our cooperation, might be directly born from the very repression that causes so much of our inner pain. A necessary neurosis, perhaps.
A profound and challenging idea to sit with.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.